Hey, you guys, it's the movie retrospective, and we're talking about a Stephen King adaptation, which I feel like a lot of people maybe don't talk about so much when they're talking about some of your better Stephen King adaptations, but this is for sure like among my favorite Stephen King adaptations.
Yeah, this is a pretty good one.
I mean, yeah, and honestly, the more times you see it, I've probably seen this. I think I saw this in the theater when it came out, like back in 2007, and I've seen it probably three or four times subsequently. Every time you see it, you pick up on more shit. And it's really cool because, I mean, this is based on a short story that came out in 1999 from that was in Everything's Eventual. And the short story is really good. I actually really liked it, but I like too the way the movie kind of like builds out from that story and like because the short story didn't really have much of a backstory like for the main character. So they really kind of had this whole like rich backstory going on, and it also goes a little bit more. I want to say the movie goes in a little bit more philosophical direction or more like a kind of descent into hell, like Dante's Inferno kind of direction. Whereas the short story, I feel like, was slightly, maybe a little bit more hinted toward Lovecraftian in the sense that in the short story, like the hotel room, room 1408, was kind of like hinted that it was sort of interdimensional in some way. Like there was some kind of entity like on the other side of it that was doing shit. Whereas, like I said, in the there's a little bit of that in the movie, but I kind of feel like the movie went more in a, the hotel is your own personal hell, and you gotta like work through shit type of situation. You know what I'm
Yeah.
saying? It was kind of like that. I've seen this movie actually called The Shining Meets Jacob's Ladder,
That's what I was thinking
which
of.
is actually a really good
If
comparison.
you like The Shining, where you had the kind of the story of a damn haunted hotel with a fucking really bad room in it, what was it called? 238? Or what was the room in The Shining? Was the name of the
Well, in
hotel
the
room?
movie, it was, wasn't it 237?
237, yeah.
But I said that wasn't that in the book,
It
though.
was
I
in the
think
book, it
they
was different,
changed
yeah.
it, but I can't
So
remember
it's
what it
kind of
was
a
in the book.
situation where a guy goes to stay in a hotel room that's like that. It's got a bad
Yeah.
reputation of being haunted. He's a paranormal investigator, paranormal writer, kind of like Janie. He's like that. And he goes in there and he thinks it's bunk, but it turns out no, it's the real shit. It's pretty good. It's pretty
Well,
good.
yeah, the thing about it, like I said, this
It's not
was
really haunted, but I mean, I guess no, it's like a hell. It's like a poor little hell. Right? Isn't that what
kinda.
you'd call it?
Well, yeah, because the thing about it, and to be honest, like since this movie came out, it did actually really well, like when it came
Yeah.
out initially. But I feel like it's developed like even more and more of a cult following, like as it's gone on, because as I said, there's so much the people have like a lot of different theories about this.
Yeah.
And some of that stems from, which I didn't even realize until recently, until I started like researching this. This movie has three or four alternate endings.
Oh, it does?
Now, we watched the version that's on Tubi at the moment. That has the theatrical ending, because that's the ending that I remember seeing when I saw this in the theater. However, it also has a director's cut ending, and we'll get into what the differences are later. It has a director's cut ending, and if you buy the Blu-ray, it only has the version with the director's cut ending, and it doesn't have the theatrical ending on it anymore. So if you want it, which is weird, you'd think they'd put all the alternate endings on there, but maybe they couldn't for various, I don't know why they couldn't, but I don't know, it seems kind of weird. And it seems like fans are kind of divided over which ending they like better. Now, I've seen the other ending, not like attached to the whole movie, like the director's cut ending, not attached to the whole movie because I've only seen the theatrical version. And I'm gonna say, even though you would think that I would probably like the director's cut version ending better because it's more of a downer, and usually I like that. And the theatrical one is kind of more of a happier ending. But to be honest, thematically, I think the theatrical ending works better than the director's cut ending. So, I don't know. I'll get into that in a little bit.
Well, I gotta say, for Dr. Sleep, no, that fucking director's cut is so much better.
Well, it depends. I mean, that was a different director. I mean, that's a completely different director and a completely different movie.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that, however, I'm not saying, across the board, all directors' cuts are necessarily better than theatrical cuts. Sometimes they're not. I mean, sometimes the director is self-indulgent, or sometimes their ideas thematically don't match up with my ideas. Thematically, like what I took from it. So I do kind of feel like, and I'm not shitting on the director of this, who's Mikhail Hafstrom, by the way, but I do like the other ending. I just think that the theatrical ending, I think thematically works better for me just because of the messaging that it puts across. So I will say that. But, you know, if you like the director's cut better, that's totally fine too. I'm not
worried
about
it. For you Stephen King movie fans or book fans, I've seen both the theatrical cut and the director's cut of Dr. Sleep, and Dr. Sleep theatrical cut, that movie got panned. I liked it. Okay, the director's cut, I'm going to give a special plug. If you don't have that director's cut, or you don't see the expanded director's cut on streaming, it's a totally different movie. It's a lot better. So I'm just giving a plug to fucking Dr. Sleep, because that was a good movie if you saw the right cut.
Yeah, and that's kind of true of any movie that has, like, multiple endings. Cuts, like I said, this one has at least three endings that I'm aware of, although two of them are kind of similar. But the theatrical ending was kind of more the quote-unquote happy ending. Yeah. So what we have here, like I said, now, interestingly, this started out as a short story. Stephen King started writing it, and I actually, if you've read his book, his nonfiction book on writing, which if you're a writer, I totally recommend. It's one of the best books about writing that I've ever read. You know, the advice and stuff that he gives in there is, like, really, really helpful. He actually started writing this story, like, at the end of that book as an example of, okay, here's my first draft of a story. Like, he wrote, like, the first however much of it. And then he's like, and now this is my first edit. And then he shows what he took out and what he changed around. So he's trying to show you, like, what his process of writing is like. And I guess that he was so kind of, like, interested. He's like, oh, you know what? That's actually a pretty good idea for a story. So he finished it. And then I think he did something called Blood and Smoke, which was, like, an audio narration, like an audiobook that he did. And then they published this in print in 1999 in Everything's Eventual, like his short story compilation. So in the short story, you're pretty much starting right when the main character is going into room 1408, this supposedly haunted room. But in the movie, obviously, they have to, like, flesh it out. So I will say, I love John Cusack in anything. I will watch John Cusack in anything. He's one of those actors that if he's in a movie, I'm like, fuck it. I don't care if the movie's bad. I love John Cusack. So I'll watch him in anything. And for the bulk of this movie, like, once he gets into the room, it's pretty much just him. Like, him in the room, like, for the second half of the movie. And he kills it. He just knocks it out of the park, I think. Because this whole movie, like, pretty much rests on his shoulders. If he was phoning it in, or if he wasn't good in it, then I don't think this movie would have been as successful as it was. So he's great when he's on his own in the room, but I also love the interactions between him and Samuel L. Jackson. Like, that whole big scene where they're setting all of it up.
Yeah.
It's just so great. Like, the interplay between the two of them is fantastic.
I was mentioning to Jenny that was watching Sam Jackson, watch him fucking do his thing. And he always, in a way, kind of plays himself, you know what I mean? But he plays him different interpretations of himself. But when you see Jackson, that's what you want. You want to see Samuel Jackson do this shit. And I'm watching him do this role, and I'm like, man, I cannot believe that he started off in Coming to America with that damn shotgun holding up McDougal's.
Yeah.
That's when you first see, because he did a good job with that, the psycho fucking with the shotgun. Dude's career went a long way.
Because he's got some fucking gravitas, man.
I never forgot that character, fucking crazy-eyed fucking dude with the fucking jacket and the fucking shotgun and McDougal's, you know. And who would have thought that dude would be a superstar?
Yeah.
You know? Well, he was so memorable. He was memorable, and I guess, you know, behind the scenes, probably everybody liked him, so he became a legend, you know? But no, he does a great job in this.
I like him in this role because it's very, I mean, for him, it's quite restrained.
Yeah. In this role, he reminds me, as I said it to Jenny at the time, I said, man, he reminds me of Will. Reminds me of Will Walker. My friend Will Walker.
Yeah, we have a friend named Will that
yeah, goth black dude. That kind of looks like him a little bit, resembles him. Big old tall dude.
Yeah, very very tall, kind of the same facial structure.
Yeah, only a little bit younger. He's a little bit older than me, and fucking that's the way.
And the way he carries himself is very much like that.
I got a video to prove it. I'm fucking loaded, and fucking Will's next to me talking to the camera and shit. I can barely stand up. He keeps hitting me on the shoulder to fucking wake me up. Remember that video? Somebody took that out of the damn phone.
That was pretty funny. But so what you have at the beginning, and like I said, I like the reason this movie, I think, just stuck with me, and the reason that it's so good, and why I think it's one of the best Stephen King adaptations, and it gets better like every single time I see it, and I keep picking more stuff up in it, because it takes its time to set it up. Because it takes a while before he even gets to the room. Like I said, the short story pretty much starts with him going to the room, and that's because it's a short story. This one kind of sets up, you know, his name's Mike Enslin. He started out as a regular novelist or a regular writer. And even though that seemed to be like the way he was doing more stuff that was, you know, based on his life and more like emotional truth and everything like that. And maybe that wasn't working out as well. And so he started writing about these paranormal things. And I don't know, I don't know if it's unclear whether, because he's going through, like, his daughter, Katie, died of, it looked like leukemia, like, presumably. And after his daughter died, him and his wife, Lily, like, drifted apart. And so he's dealing with that. And he also has a thing where he's just angry. He's angry at the world because, you know, he's angry at God because he perceives God as, so he's become, like, this bitter atheist because he's kind of like, well, why would a God take, you know, my daughter away from me like that? And so he's just really, really cranky about the whole thing. So I'm not sure if it was before or after his daughter died that he went into this paranormal type of thing. He might have been doing it before, but when you meet him at the beginning of the book, he's still writing these presumably still successful books, even though it looks like the success of them is on the decline, you know, because he goes to a book signing, there's only like three people there.
Yeah.
But he writes these books, like, you know, 10 haunted hotels and all this other kind of stuff, but he doesn't believe it. He's basically just doing it at this point to help out the hotels that he's, yeah, it's totally haunted, whatever. And he's like, but he doesn't really believe it. So it's almost kind of like he's defrauding people because he doesn't believe in ghosts anymore. Yeah. So, I mean, I took it as he was writing that before, but then, I don't know, but then like his daughter died and he's like, okay, I don't believe this shit anymore, but I'm still going to write it for the money. Or he started writing it after because he just went on this cynical type, you know, so either way.
During this part of the movie, man, I'm kind of like, I'm going, man, this dude's in a way kind of like Jenny.
Yeah.
But Jenny's written a lot of paranormal stuff, but always from a neutral standpoint. She, in general, does not believe that it's spirits of the dead. There's other explanations that are paranormal also, which some of the books get into that. But she's seen paranormal activity. It's just that I agree with her. You guys have seen, if you've read Math Mountain Poltergeist, if you read that, I lived through it. It scared the shit out of me at the time, and it was paranormal, but I don't think it was the spirits of the dead. RSPK. Recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. There's some scientific theories that explain that with quantum, entangled particles having to do with quantum consciousness, which is some heavy duty quantum mechanics where the mind might be able to alter matter slightly, or at least your perception of matter, which what is matter? You know, they don't know. But that paranormal can be explained in quantum mechanics and quantum terms sometimes, if it seems to be a legitimate phenomenon. Some of it's made up. Like Mothman, it's made up.
But I kind of feel like in this, you know, context of the movie, he seems more like just anything and everything. He's very cynical about it. Like, everything's bullshit. He's just doing it for the money. Right. And it's almost kind of like, but I kind of feel like, in a way, he almost has like a little kernel of hope left. Like, it's kind of like Houdini, kind
he
of
got
where,
burned out
where he was skeptical about it, but then he's like, he kept hoping that it would be true because, you know, he could talk to his dead mother again or whatever. So I do kind of feel like there's that little kernel of him in there somewhere that he's like, well, maybe, like, there's a possibility there's an afterlife, I can see my daughter again. But the way he presents at the beginning of the movie is very cynical, very sardonic, very sarcastic. It's just... he's doing it for the money. Even they show, which I really like, they show, like, a little bit of a prologue at the beginning of him going to a supposedly haunted hotel and, like, the couple that own it, like, a bed and breakfast or whatever. And they're really excited that he's there. And they're like, oh, we got to tell you about all the ghosts that are in the thing and all this other stuff. And he's just like, yeah, whatever. Just give me my keys. It's like, and he just sits in the room. And then he's kind of dictating into his thing. Yeah, five skulls, whatever. It's just, you know what I mean? He's just like really over it at this point.
I don't think that's the only reason why he's holding out hope, though. Because he said some other stuff that made me think that he did believe that it was a possibility. He said that, I've been to some places where some bad shit happened, and yeah, you could get a real heavy feeling there, the feelings.
Although he was just saying that to the lady, because that was what he was expected to say.
Maybe, I don't know, because I've been in places like that, bad feelings.
Yeah, but his character, the way his character was at the beginning, was he did not believe in anything like that, but he was just answering her question, to make her feel better. So it's like, so buy the book for me, kind of thing.
My interpretation was that he did have bad feelings and that he was thinking that, maybe there's something to it, but maybe not. Just might have just been feelings. But that's what I was thinking. I was thinking that he did have the ability to kind of sense it. That was my interpretation. But maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, but so at this point, so I guess since he's still kind of well known for doing these kind of like 10 haunted hotels, and like I said, he's writing these books to kind of help out the hotel owners because everyone will come there if it has a ghost story attached to it. So he gets in the mail like all of these flyers and shit like that from other hotels. So he gets this postcard, and this postcard that he gets, which does not have a return address on it, although the stamp is New York City where the hotel is. All it says, it's addressed to him, and all it says is, don't enter 1408. And he's pretty, he's pretty intrigued by this, because he's like, oh, this is new. Like, if this is a hotel that's wanting me to, like, investigate their scary room, then this is, like, a new, like, a novel way to go about it, like some kind of mystery. So this kind of intrigues him. Now, as I said, you never find out, like, who sent this postcard to him. And that's another thing that's, like, a cause of a lot of different theories about the movie. One of the theories being that Samuel L. Jackson's character, Olin, who is the manager of the Dolphin, where room 1408 is actually the devil. I'm not sure I buy that exactly. My kind of theory is I think that it's almost kind of like... I don't, like, not literally, but I think in some ways, like, John Cusack's character, I think he kind of sent that to himself. Mm. Or it could have been, like, Samuel L. Jackson's character, but I don't think Samuel L. Jackson's the devil, though. Although I do think that there's a thing with the hotel room, like I said, being a sort of, like, not necessarily descent into hell, but kind of like Dante's Inferno, where you kind of like go through all the sins of your life and expunge them and then come out on the other side better. You know what I'm saying? Whether that's out into heaven or out into whatever, I do kind of feel like it's that. But I don't know who summoned him there necessarily. It might have been like a future version of him or something. So he gets this postcard, and as I said, it's intriguing. He points out, oh, the number's 1408. That also adds up to 13, and he's like, oh, okay, that's, you know, that's cool that they went that far into doing it. So then he actually does go to New York. There's a whole big thing where his publisher is like, are you sure you want to go back to New York? Presumably, that's where his estranged wife still lives, that's where his daughter died, so it's going to be this big emotional thing. And he's like, no, it's just a job, it's fine. So he goes back to the hotel. Now, interestingly, when he gets there, Olin, the manager, Samuel L. Jackson, just is really, really does not want him to stay in that room. Now, John Cusack is apparently, he's kind of like, yeah, I know, like, the whole song and dance. Ooh, it's so scary. You don't want me to stay in there. Liability, yada, yada. He thinks it's all part of the sizzle that they're selling. You know what I mean? Like, this room is so haunted, we can't have anybody stay in there. But Samuel L. Jackson is like, no, I'm fucking serious. This room is fucking evil, he says. And, so John Cusack had done all this research. All of these people died in the room. jumping out the window, you know, just slitting their wrists or whatever. And then Olin's like, yeah, but did you hear about all the people that died, quote unquote, natural deaths in there? Like one dude that drowned in his chicken soup and shit like that. And he had not heard of that. So he's like, 56 deaths have happened in this room. Nobody lasts more than an hour. They're like, we do clean it, but we leave the door open and we go in shifts. And there's only in there for like 10 minutes at a time. And so I really, really like the setup. It's a pretty long like conversation between the two of them where they're setting up like all the shit that happened in this room.
I think it's the best part of the movie, actually.
It is, actually. That scene is really good. And like I said, I really like that the movie took the time to set it all up.
Yeah.
So then when he gets to the room, like however long in it is, like 45 minutes or whatever, you're kind of like primed for the shit that starts to happen. And the interesting thing about this room, and he even brings this up, he's like, the room isn't haunted. They're like, in the sense that there's ghosts in it, even though a bunch of people have died in it. Basically, all Samuel L. Jackson says at first, he's like, it's just a fucking evil room. What the room seems to do, kind of like, I guess The Shining, well, no, I guess The Shining didn't really do this either, but it's kind of like more along the lines of, it targets the individual that is staying in the room and essentially gives you your own personal descent into hell. So it will do things that are meaningful to you specifically, and it seems like it essentially wants to drive you mad so that you will kill yourself.
Yeah.
And that's going to be different for each person.
You're not really going to get an explanation of how or why. If there is, I didn't make
it. Just is.
It's some kind of a rift in between dimensions, or it's just some kind of an effect that this... Like, why is it happening way up high on a floor inside of a hotel? It never really explains it. It's just a bad place.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, it doesn't have to, because it's almost, it's like a metaphorical journey. And honestly, there's a great video, I can't remember what it's called, but it was like half an hour long. You'll find it if you like look for 1408 Explained or something like that. And it's several years old, but this guy did like a half an hour examination of 1408 and compared it with Dante's Inferno, and it's almost, it's not like a one-to-one matchup, but it's very, very close. All of the stuff that happens to him in this room, like, you know, the room getting too hot, like the room getting freezing cold, like the person that comes after him with the hammer, so like that, it all has to do with his sins that he's trying to expunge, like while he's in this room. And it all has to do with, like, you know, as you descend down the layers. And honestly, he even says, like, when the room goes freezing cold, he even brings up Dante's Inferno and is trying to remember what level of hell this was. So it was very deliberate. And honestly, if you look at a summary of Inferno and look at a summary of this movie, like every single thing that happens to him in this, it's very, very similar. So obviously it was done on purpose, which is why I kind of like, which is why I like the theatrical ending better, because it's more, he went through his own personal hell. The room didn't defeat him. He actually destroyed the room and was willing to sacrifice himself to do so. But he didn't die. He came out of it on the other side with all of his sins expunged as a better person. So I think, and also he got his faith back, because he, when he got out in the theatrical cut, he gets out and the only thing he saved was his tape recorder. And when he plays the tape recorder back, him and his wife, who have gotten back together, hear their dead daughter's voice on it. So he's basically like, oh, faith, you know, an afterlife exists, ghosts exist. So he's gotten his faith back. In the director's cut, which, like I said, if you buy it on Blu-ray now, I believe, at least in the United States, the Blu-ray, it only has the director's cut ending on it. That one, John Cusack's character actually dies in the fire. He is sacrificing himself to destroy the room so other people don't get fucked over by it. But he dies, and then in the one, like, Samuel L. Jackson, like, gets all of his stuff, and he plays the tape and hears the daughter's voice. And then there's like a jump scare where you see like a burned looking John Cusack in the back of his car. And then he looks and he sees a little girl, which you presume is Katie, the dead daughter. And you see John Cusack and they're like walking away across the cemetery, like at John Cusack's funeral. Which, that's an okay ending too, but I do kind of feel like that sort of makes everything that he went through in that room, like the ordeal that he suffered through, it made it like not mean anything. Although I guess he did end up with his daughter in the afterlife, but I don't know. I'm kind of two minds about it. You know what I'm saying? I didn't like the cheapy jump scare thing where Samuel L. Jackson looks in the rearview mirror of his car and like then sees like burned John Cusack in the back, like as a jump scare. Cause it seemed just, you know, that's something that a lot of horror movies do. So I didn't love that as much. I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about which one I liked better. I think I liked the theatrical cut better.
Okay.
To be honest with you, but I don't know. I think there's another one too where I think that that actually the publisher comes back and the book that he wrote where he was like inside the thing, because there's a thing where you know, you think that he's out of the room at some point, like you think that this whole thing happened after he like got hit in the head with a surfboard or whatever, because they do put that in there, and that's also a reference to Dante's Inferno, by the way, like waking up on the shore of something and you kind of being dead. So they do that, but for a long time you think he actually got out of the room, and then he goes back to like living his life and it seems like he's sorted everything out, but then he goes to the post office and they start tearing, which is a great scene, by the way. Like, they tear down the walls and he's still in the room and he's like flipping out because obviously he hasn't like worked through all his shit yet. But I mean, so you had never seen this movie before?
No.
You had never seen it. Okay. So,
you know nothing about it.
Yeah. So, what did you think about it?
I liked it.
You did?
Yeah. The best part, I think, was the first part with Sam Jackson and everything, you know, doing the setup. That was really my favorite part of it. It was good. It went a little bit out there with I knew it was going to go out there though, but it was nowhere near like as crazy as like Maximum Overdrive or anything like that. You know, it was good. I would probably put this in there. Like, this could exist in the same universe as Dr. Sleep. You know.
Yeah.
That's how I saw it. The extended cut Dr. Sleep. I like that.
I did kind of like the way. Yeah, I mean, it does go kind of, like, out there, like, you know, the room.
The room falling away.
Falling away and stuff like that. But like I said,
he's hallucinating, you know.
But he's hallucinating, yeah. So you can do anything with that. Although right. I will say that the creepiest shit in it to me is the more subtle shit. Like, I love the scene where he looks out the window, because he's, like, looking, like, for help, because he can't get out. And he sees somebody in the window, like, in the building across the street, and he's, like, waving at them and stuff, and then it turns out that it's him. Yeah. And I was just, and if you guys, like, after we reviewed, like, Roman Polanski's The Tenant, where it's kind of a similar thing happens, that kind of shit creeps me the fuck out.
Yeah.
That creeps me the fuck out.
This story here, you know, if you guys know the backstory between me and Jenny and some of the stuff that she's written together, you know, me and her have written it together with, you know, like, Math Mountain Poltergeist. I've always had weird stuff happen to me. Every decade, something weird would happen. There'd be witnesses and shit through most of it. This kind of reminds me of a time. The story, you know, kind of reminds me of a time when I got out of the Army. A friend of mine named Eric, we got out at the same time. We moved to Boston together because we had planned it. And we rented a house, and it was just a bad house. It wasn't nowhere near as bad as this hotel.
Yeah, because some crazy shit happens in this one.
you'd be dating girls and bring them over, and they were, like, scared to walk around the house together. You had to stand outside the damn bathroom while they were using the bathroom and shit. It just was just an eerie house that, you know, gave you bad dreams, and seemed to be always something over your shoulder watching you, trying to crush you. It was just a very oppressive house, and never really got down to the bottom of it. Just, you know, I've told the story on a live show, you know, how that got resolved. Just had to threaten it with, if you keep fucking with me, I'm going to burn the house down, and that dispelled it. Whatever it was, I don't know if it was a ghost, or there was no visual phenomenon, no objects moved. It was just waves of emotion. That's the only way I can describe it. This hotel story kind of reminded me of that.
Although I did like that when he first walks in, he's basically like, this is it. Like, it just looks like regular. Yeah. And it kind of starts a little bit subtle. Like, he goes in the bathroom or whatever. He has, like, his back turned. And then when he comes out, there's, like, chocolates on the pillow. And, like, somebody fixed the toilet paper and shit like that. And he's just like, wait, was somebody in here, like, while my back was turned, like, for a second? Yeah. So I really like that it kind of started like that. And another one of my favorite scenes, too, is when he's finally, like, freaking out. And he's just kind of like, okay, I really got to get the fuck out of this room. He can't get out the door. And so he climbs out the window onto the ledge, and he's going to go to the next room, like climb in the window next door. And so then he gets out on the ledge, and then he goes like that, and then it's just like all wall with like no windows. I really, really like that. Because see, little shit like that, to me, is scarier than like the big, because I like that, you know, I like how over the top this was at some point, because like I said, he does think that he's hallucinating, and because it's essentially, I don't know, not literally, but it is kind of like happening in his mind, and it is personal to him, so it's stuff that would bother him specifically, you know, an ordeal that he has to go through. So they can go as crazy as they need to with it.
Yeah.
So I do like that. There are a couple of apparitions, like you do see, you know, kind of one of an older guy that like jumped out the window, like back in 1912 or whatever.
Or he's seeing the past.
Or he's seeing the past in it. Yeah. So he does see that, which, you know, I guess is not specifically personal to him, but he did read about those cases. So I guess that's kind of like coming. Yeah. But I mean, I, like I said, I kind of like the subtle shit of like, you know, the radio coming on with that Carpenters song and, you know, and then it counting down like 60 minutes because, you know, Olin told him nobody lasts more than an hour in there. Yeah. You know, usually they die or they run out of their screaming. So it's that kind of thing.
All these stories about haunted places and bad places and paranormal stuff, it all comes from stories that people have passed down. And sometimes the stories grow, you know. And horror writers will write a story based upon something that's out there. These stories go back thousands of years. In my experience, there's something to them. People do have these experiences. But when you see a story like this, don't take it literally. A real experience isn't as dramatic as these stories. They're very much, you know, they're made into movies, you know.
Yeah.
If it's something, in my experience, if something actually does happen to you, it's not, it can be pretty damn intense, but it's not as intense as this.
Yeah, because as I said, the thing about this was that it kind of starts out like a little bit of a haunting type thing.
Yeah.
Like I said, where, oh, there's chocolates on the pillows and they weren't here before. So there's that kind of stuff. But as it ramps up, it sort of gets more, like I said, it gets more crazy, but it's also kind of like, it had to be crazy because I think, I mean, metaphorically at least, it's an ordeal that he has to go through. And then when he gets to the end, it's just like battering him like emotionally. It's like down to nothing.
Yeah.
So it has to be really intense, and it's of like a really intense experience. Yeah. And then when he gets through that, you know, at the end, basically the clock resets after all of the crazy shit, and it says, well, you can either live through this same hour over and over and over again, or you can do what the lady at the front desk calls the express checkout, meaning that they want him to kill himself.
Yeah.
However, he takes a third route because he has worked through the shit.
Yeah, so they have to visually show you in a cinematic form what this guy's going through internally.
Yeah.
Which, the house that we're in was kind of like that. Not like I said, nowhere near as intense as this. I would say, in Star Wars terminology, it would be like it's a story about a place that is strong with the dark side, and like the fucking place where Luke has the damn vision of Vader, you know, in fucking Empire Strikes Back. There are places in my experience that are bad. I don't know why. You can't explain it.
Yeah.
Not with modern science. Maybe eventually they will. Probably something to do with quantum particles. Some traces of something left behind.
I do kind of feel like it's been a while since I read the short story. I did read a synopsis of it earlier today, and I was reading something that was like comparing and contrasting the two. As I mentioned earlier, I feel like the short story was more suggesting that the room was almost like interdimensional. Almost, I want to say, like slightly Lovecraftian.
Yeah.
In the sense that it wasn't really explained, but there was one point in the story, if I remember correctly, where the wall kind of cracked, which happens in the movie too, but it's not quite the same, where the wall kind of cracked and you could just see like a hint of something like behind there, like some kind of entity of some kind, which, yeah, like I said, very Lovecraftian. Whereas I feel like the movie, rightly so, I feel like, went in a more, as I said, in Dante's Inferno direction, yeah, where they're making it much more clear, at least subtextually, that this is something that he's going through,
yeah,
internally, like,
yeah,
in his head.
Well, it's the mind, it's consciousness.
That's manifesting, yeah, outward. Because, you know, the room, when it resets, you know, when the clock resets after 60 minutes, the room looks normal again, yeah, even though obviously there's been cracks and shit's fallen down and he's like torn the shit up, and it just, so it resets itself. Yeah. You know what I mean? So
anything's possible if it's messing with your consciousness. I mean, we don't really know what consciousness is or how to, yeah, make anything conscious. It's something quantum mechanical. It's not digital, or the internet would be conscious. It's so once you're dealing in that realm, anything's possible, you know. So they're just trying to communicate that the place is mind warping.
Which it definitely is. Yeah. So I mean, if you've never seen this movie and you really like Stephen King movies, you really like John Cusack, you really like mindfuck kind of movies.
Yeah.
Like I said, Shining meets Jacob's Ladder, and I think it might have been Ryan Hollinger that said that, and I was like, I think that's probably the best descriptor, yeah, of this movie that I've ever heard.
And electromagnetism and electromagnetic fields can fuck up your mind. They've tried to weaponize it with guns to fucking hit people's heads and give them brain damage and make them, put them in bad moods and stuff. So who's to say that a place can't be like that? Maybe some kind of an electromagnetic field coming out of the earth. You don't know.
Well, I mean, it does happen because, yeah, you know, they have done experiments where certain, right, types of electromagnetic fields or,
right,
or something like that, like, do,
right,
affect people's brains in, yeah, in particular frequencies.
And it may not necessarily be the physical brain. It might be the damn field of subatomic particles and quantum particles that are around the brain that's giving you that sensation of existence. If you can warp those, it would have a mind-warping effect on your consciousness. So, movie might be plausible.
Another thing that
I was in a place that made you kind of feel really bad.
Another thing that I kind of liked about this, too, and this, yeah, really went along with, like, his character, you know, him being a cynic and a skeptic. Like, when he first goes in the room, and it's just kind of like, oh, it just looks like a regular room.
Yeah.
And then when the little shit happens, like the chocolate on the thing, and he immediately thinks, he goes to, like, the rational thing, like you would think, oh, somebody snuck in here, like, behind my back. So, yeah, he starts looking for a person. And then, like, as shit gets crazier and crazier, he still is trying to find a rational explanation. He's like, oh, well, you know, Olin gave me this expensive $800 bottle of whiskey. He must have dosed it.
He dosed with LSD.
So I'm, like, hallucinating. Yeah. So he's kind of, like, trying to rationalize, yeah, what's happening to him. And he does that for, I mean, which you would do.
Yeah.
And especially somebody with that character. So I really do
especially
like that.
Especially if you've been on LSD before.
Yeah.
I've been dosed.
Yeah, so I like that they, yeah, address that, because he's like, oh, you know, I've been drinking out of this bottle that this, yeah, dude gave me. Who knows? He could have put something in there. Which, you know, maybe if that's another interpretation of the movie, right, maybe he did just dose
all along.
Maybe he
know.
Just dosed him. I'm like, that's
a good ass trip.
That I know. Well, or a bad one. That seems like the most boring explanation, but that's also another alternate explanation for this movie. But yeah, so this movie is actually, at the moment, as of this recording, it's, you can watch it for free on Tubi, but keep in mind that the ending on the Tubi version is the theatrical version.
Yeah.
If you buy this on Blu-ray, and I'm not sure about if you watch this on other streaming services, the Blu-ray only has the director's cut, the bummer ending, yeah, whereas the theatrical cut is the more hopeful or positive ending. So keep that in mind, like, whichever. And like I said, there's another ending too, but I've never seen the other one, like with the publisher getting a book and stuff. But
my interpretation of the movie was that it was a location that was, I'm going to give it Star Wars terminology, it was a location that was strong with the dark side. You went in there and you underwent a damn inquisition or a trial for your soul.
That's pretty much, yeah.
And it either purified you when you came out the other end, or it killed you. That's what it was. It was like
That's exactly right.
It was basically a spiritual crucible.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's how, I mean, that's, like I said, also how I interpreted it.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was.
And I think the reason I like the theatrical cut better is because he, you know, he comes out of it alive because he had gotten rid of all, he had expiated his sins. He'd gotten rid of the selfishness and the ego that had gotten him into that situation in the first place by being willing to sacrifice himself to destroy the room so no one else would have to go through it.
So
you know what I mean? So he
dismantled it using the force, because like
his
a sorcerer.
Because his wife was coming. Yeah. They said, oh, your wife is here. She's coming up. And he's like, I have to destroy this room. I don't want her going through this, like coming into this room because it's evil. So the fact that he was willing to sacrifice himself meant that he had learned, he had expiated all his sins, so he just gets to go on to paradise in Dante's Inferno terms. So that's kind of where I got. But yeah, I like spiritual crucible. That's a really good phrase for what it is.
In the Eastern philosophy, spirituality is not intellectualism. It's a holistic. It's a merger of mind and body, the two different forces of chi, of yin and yang, good and evil, trying to find balance and the line between the two. So the idea of swordsmen who are psychics that are walking in between the line between good and evil, that's all Jedi stuff, all right? And that's what this is kind of about, too, all right? It's not about scientific rationality. It's about instinct and feelings and emotion, you know? There is some logic to it. But it's not all that. It goes outside that. It goes into the realm of the spiritual. And wherever this place was, like I said, a spiritual crucible. You went in there and you tore yourself apart, basically, to get down to your core, which is kind of like in Zoroastrianism. You go to hell to burn off impurities. All right. And when you come out of there, purified.
Yeah, that's
or
essentially.
Or it killed you.
Yeah, that's essentially what's going on.
Right.
And the fact that he was able to resist the room, because like I said, the room gives him a choice at the end, saying you can relive the same hour again forever and ever, or you can kill yourself, but he chooses instead to destroy the room to keep anyone else from having to go through the same thing that he went through, which meant that he had won the contest or beat the room, I guess.
Yeah, that in Star Wars terms, that'd be Yoda absorbing the chi ball and going, nope, and just dismantling it.
Nope.
Be kind of like, in Christian terms, it would be exorcism, to exorcise a bad place, to just do the same thing.
And like I said, the more times I see this movie, which is fascinating because this came out in 2007, and I kind of feel like 2007, most of the horror movies that came out around that time were usually like all torture porn. Yeah. So the fact that like a big Hollywood studio made this, and it's actually kind of, I mean, you can watch it as just like a creepy supernatural haunted, you know, hotel room movie too. But the fact that it has like all of these other philosophical kind of like layers to it, that you kind of pick up more and more, like as you watch, the more times you watch it, is kind of pretty amazing. I'm glad that people really seem to like it at the time. It wasn't one of those movies where everyone was like, what the fuck is this? And then like later, it was actually like very well reviewed at the time and actually made, you know, decent money at the time. So people did recognize it for being like a pretty awesome movie at the time it was. But I do feel like the appreciation for it has grown like as the years have gone by though too. But yeah, so if you've seen it, let me know what you think about it. Let me know which ending you like better, or if you even knew that it had several different endings, because I actually didn't realize that until quite recently. So yeah, that'll do it for this movie retrospective on 1408, and we'll see you guys on the next one. Bye.